using taxpayer dollars to send kids to private schools. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Orlando Sentinel has come out with a new investigative series that looks at the state programs that give scholarships to families so their kids can go to private schools. But what do parents know about these private schools, which don't have to be regulated by the state? Tens of thousands of people in South Florida need food assistance, even now, more than a month after Hurricane Irma. But getting that help can take a while. We'll find out why. Then we'll talk about a unique celestial event that's still underway. We geek out over astronomy. That's all coming up next on Sundial here on WLRN. First, the news. Welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Well, earlier this month, we had reported on the long lines of people who were trying to get food assistance due to Hurricane Irma. Those lines had stretched around parks and roads. People had to stand out in the sun for hours. In some places, there was confusion about where lines started and ended. The assistance is called DSNAP, provided by the Department of Children and Families, and there will be more opportunities for folks to get help. But have officials fixed the problems to make the process easier and smoother? Well, we're joined now by WLRN's Wilson Sayre, who reported on this story. Wilson, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you.
All right. We go back to this happened in Miami-Dade and Broward, Palm Beach counties, and we saw these images, these videos. You posted stuff up on WLRN.org. Hundreds, thousands of people in line waiting for hours and hours and hours. We heard about people waiting for, they had lined up at midnight just to be ready for the next day. But why did that happen? Why were these long lines? What was the process that made it last so long?
Yeah, so Disaster Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program is intended for people who don't otherwise qualify for food stamps, is what we generally call them. But because they suffered some losses during Hurricane Irma, they needed a little extra help. And so there's pretty expansive requirements for people who can get food stamps under DSNAP. And so there's a combination of a lot of people. You know, there's incredible divides between the rich and the poor here in South Florida. We have a lot of people who are working, who are, you know, paycheck to paycheck, who in a disaster like Irma, even though it wasn't that bad, needed some help. So we have a combination of lots of people, but also people had to go in person to one of just a handful of locations to register. And only for 7 days was the initial rollout for this program during the week. So some people only had, you know, 1 or 2 days during the weekend when they had an option of even going.
When they went and they showed up to register, once they got to inside into that point to do so, I mean, what was the process? I had read that it was actually kind of smooth compared to just waiting in line.
Yeah. So most of the people I talked to, once they got to the front door of these tents, it was 5-10 minutes. The process really was just waiting in line. So once they got in, either they had pre-registered, filling out a form of, you know, what their monthly income is, what losses they suffered, how many people are in their family. And so there's some sort of a short interview process, which is actually why it has to be in person. They need to be face to face with a person who's sort of verifying what's going on their application. And then they're handed a card, and they're told within 72 hours that will be filled. Now, we did find some people who their cards were not filled within 72 hours, though most of that seems to have been sort of smoothed over now.
And you think 72 hours, I mean, it's just a few days, but for some people, that's a few days. You're talking about people who are just to be able to feed their families.
Yeah. I mean, that was a big complaint of Disaster SNAP, is that why is it coming a month after Hurricane Irma? And despite its name, I mean, the people who on the federal level administer the program, the U.S. Department of Agriculture, it's not about being the first step, sort of first wave of protection for people who need help. This comes later in the process because you need to have things like credit card machines up and running, stores that are stocked. And here down in South Florida, we know that already existed. So there's this ongoing complaint about why it took so long.
This is federal help, and yet what role is the Department of Children and Families in all of this?
Yeah, so it's a federal program, just like SNAP, but it's a state that actually rolls it out. So they determine where you actually go to register, what that process is going to look like. They're the ones who request DSNAP to get up and running. Those negotiations take a really long time, and that's one of the reasons that this isn't the first line of defense for people who need food assistance.
Did the folks at DCF know what was coming? Were they not prepared when they all of a sudden see these long lines of people? Is it just they didn't have enough people to work it?
Well, so I think really it's you can only handle so many people at a certain site. When you have three sites in Broward County, four sites in Miami-Dade County, I mean, you're going to get a lot of people, and you can only have 7 days. So whether they were blindsided by 50,000 people in line, no one's told me on the record that they were blindsided by that. I think a lot of people who work within these communities, who work in social services, know that there's a lot of need. But I think the real crunch point is at the federal level, because any variance from the plan has to go for approval from the federal government. And the state actually did request to extend statewide the registration process. And the federal government came back and said, actually, we need more evidence that you actually need it, despite the fact that we have, news reports of 50,000 people in line and people, fainting of heat exhaustion, that kind of thing. So I think that's really where the crunch point is here.
Talking to WLRN's Wilson Sarah again, talking about that story of DSNAP, which, of course, is the program to help folks who are in need of food assistance due to Hurricane Irma. This is a federal program, but as mentioned, run right now by the Department of Children and Families, the State Department of Children and Families. And we saw those stories, and maybe you were one of those folks who were in that line waiting for hours and hours to qualify, just to apply for this assistance. We've had this very strange summer in that first there was Harvey in Houston, then Irma here in Florida and the Keys, and of course Maria in Puerto Rico. But how did what happened in Houston, which was shortly before Irma, impact or had, do we know if it's impacted the way assistance is being doled out in Florida?
Well, so the federal government will say that there hasn't been any impact on the amount that's available or their ability to roll things out. In fact, a week before Miami-Dade and Broward started their registration, Houston just wrapped theirs up. And the hurricane in Houston, Harvey, was a month before. And so there was even more complaints in Texas about how long it took to roll out. But we see a lot of the same issues where there's really long lines, extra days that are planned come days later and in sites that are inaccessible. We don't know how that's going to roll out in South Florida. Broward County will get three extra days because the sheriff's office shut down the last day because of concerns about health and safety of those in line. Miami-Dade will get one extra day just because of the demand. There are so many people in line and they weren't able to get to everybody. And so we're not sure how that's going to roll out. But in Houston, they got three extra days, I believe, two or three extra days. And it was in the site that was pretty inaccessible. And so the sort of narrative about long lines and how are people finding out about it, how are people getting there, those are very similar. And I think sort of maybe in a postmortem, there'll be some conversations about whether or not this is a system that actually works to get people help.
You talked about a moment ago how you had to show up in person, but is there any conversation about trying to set this up so it's a lot quicker and not in person, online perhaps, maybe on your mobile phone that you could just, we apply for all kinds of things online.
Right.
Why do we need to show up and prove that we're in need?
Good question. And I actually asked an official with the U.S. Department of Agriculture about that. There is no conversation on the national level about making this digitized. Registration for regular SNAP benefits is online. It's a rule on the federal level. I'm sure there's going to be lots of discussion about whether that should change. But the federal government's response is, well, they need to come in person person so we can give them a card. And I've heard lots of people suggest alternatives, ways of getting people their cards and doing the verification process, which is this in-person interview. They're around the country. There's been some experimentation with Skype. But at this point, I mean, that is not going to be implemented on a national level.
Do we know of, I think you had just mentioned this again, that DCF is trying to extend the days and get some more days for folks in Florida, not just South Florida?
Yeah, so they made that request to the federal government, along with the request to extend it statewide. The federal government approved 3 more days for Broward County and 1 more day for Miami-Dade County. Now, anybody in South Florida or anybody in any affected area where there was disaster declared in that county, they can go to one of these sites and register. So people in Palm Beach County who didn't get a chance to register can go to one of the sites in Dade and Broward. But you're going to be facing the same issues most people suspect. Long lines, not great conditions. I mean, it's hot and it's rainy sometimes. And so it's not, you know, the best to wait for 5, 6, 7, 8 or 9 hours for some.
I remember talking with a Palm Beach Post reporter about what happened in Palm Beach, and the one that they had at John Prince Park, I believe it is. There was a confusion about which line you're supposed to be in. They wouldn't let anybody on foot in. You had to be in your car. It's just the way the park was set up. But I mean, if you have questions about what you're supposed to bring, how it's set up, where the line's going to be, and to make sure you're in the right line, or, you know, I mean, can you call somebody, or is that information posted somewhere? So you can get all of that before you go.
So the information about what you need to bring and the pre-registration is online under, it's called Food for Florida. That's what DSNAP is being called in Florida. So if you Google Food for Florida, you can find the site information, the registration form. Now, they do encourage you to pre-register. You do not have to pre-register. You will still have to wait in line. But once you get to the tent, it'll streamline it a little bit for you. So you can find that information. They don't have the information posted about the upcoming registration in Dade and Broward, but information about parking and all that stuff. It is not on there. In fact, when I went to Amelia Earhart Park when Miami-Dade was doing their registration, I parked in the park where everybody else was and walked 25 minutes to get to the site. I knew what I was looking for, and I just couldn't find where it was in the park because it's a pretty big park. And so, I mean, we had a trail of people doing the same thing. So there isn't, as far as I could tell, a centralized place about where to park, how they're doing it, because in the 2 sites that I went to, you couldn't stay in your car. So it seems to be location by location. There are location officials at each of the locations who are organizing them, but they're all being done differently.
I almost wonder if you just have to go on Twitter and see what people are saying about what a line is doing or what to do.
Yes, and that is how a lot of people found out about the registration, word of mouth. It wasn't necessarily social services telling people, like, this is how you can get help. But there has been some misinformation going around. So be careful about, you know, what you're seeing online.
And just as you said, be ready, because that line will be long. WLRN's Wilson Sarah again talking about DSNAP. Thanks so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
All right. Coming up, the Orlando Sentinel dug into school vouchers and scholarships. What did they uncover about private schools? We'll talk about that coming up next here on Sundial on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. The Orlando Sentinel recently published a 3-part series called Schools Without Rules. It was a months-long investigation into private schools whose students receive scholarships from the state of Florida, even though the schools don't get much oversight from state education officials. These scholarships, or vouchers, have been around for a couple of decades now, and they've become very popular, as the number of kids using them has tripled in the past decade. As the Orlando Sentinel pointed out, there are now more than 140,000 students in the state using them this year. Now, though the scholarships are controversial because public tax dollars are sending these kids to private schools, the investigation really looked into the schools that were failing, that hired people with criminal records, and that were housed in substandard facilities. And we're joined now by two of the reporters from the Orlando Sentinel who worked on the series, Leslie Postal and Beth Kassab. Leslie, Beth, thank you so much for joining me today.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah, thanks for having us.
You know what, real quickly, why is the state of Florida paying private school tuition? I think we need to just kind of explain that.
Well, these programs were really started on the idea that parents should have more options, should have more choices, and that perhaps sometimes when public schools weren't doing a good job or parents felt they weren't doing a good job, a private school might be a better option for some children.
And I apologize, real quickly, since you're both up in Orlando, if you could tell me who's talking when you guys jump in. So I know.
I'm sorry, that was Leslie. I'm Leslie.
Okay, gotcha. You know what, so these programs are meant to provide alternatives to families whose local public schools are substandard? Is that what it is?
Well, the scholarship has taken different forms. An early version of this program did speak specifically to failing public schools. So I think it was if a school had received an F letter grade within a four-year time frame. Is that right, Leslie?
It was two Fs in a four-year time frame.
In a four-year time frame, then a child at that failing school could be eligible for a voucher. That program eventually ended because it was ruled unconstitutional. But these other programs have continued. So we now have three programs, the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship, the McKay Scholarship, and the Gardner Scholarship. And these, the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship pays for children who are from low-income families to attend private school. So the thinking being that these are families that would not be able to afford private school tuition on their own. So the scholarship program helps them in that way. And the other two scholarships help children who have a wide range of disabilities.
And Leslie, we keep hearing the word voucher, but help us understand the difference between the vouchers, scholarship.
Well, I mean, the state calls all the programs scholarships because that's what they provide. They provide, you know, a way for families to get a scholarship to go to these private schools. The term voucher, you know, it sort of has different meanings depending on who says it, but it tends to mean a direct funding from the state the state budget to the parent to pay for private school. And the tax credit scholarship program is not funded that way. That's why we tend to just say they're all scholarships. But that they all do the same thing. I mean, they all provide a way for parents to pay for private school.
Right, and that tax credit money, so those are essentially a business can donate to a fund that pays for these scholarships instead of paying its taxes. So it's money that otherwise would go into the state budget if this program didn't exist.
So that's the incentive, is you don't have to pay your taxes, your state taxes, if you put money into this fund. But do they have to put a certain amount into that fund?
It's a one-for-one credit, so what they donate, they get off their tax bill.
I see. Beth, how much are these schools getting in these scholarships?
Well, the amount varies from school to school. But when you add up the amounts being spent on all three scholarship programs, it's close to $1 billion here in the state of Florida. And, you know, some schools are receiving millions of dollars each year in the form of these scholarships, and some are receiving, you know, tens of thousands of dollars or a few hundred thousand dollars. The amounts each school receive range quite a bit.
Leslie, I'd mentioned, again, this comes from the report, 140,000 students this year. Beth just mentioned $1 billion. How many private schools are we talking about?
It's nearly 2,000 across the state, so it's a lot of private schools.
And what kind of private schools are these?
They run the gamut. A lot of Catholic schools take part, so those are kind of your traditional, you know, K-8 Catholic schools and some of the Catholic high schools as well. There's other, on the other end, you know, very little schools that have just cropped up in the last few years. They may be in renting church space. They may be in, you know, little shopping centers. They may be in little, you know, office plazas. Just some are daycares that have decided to add, you know, the upper grades to take scholarship students. They really run the gamut.
And do you have either an exact number or even a rough estimate of how many of these schools are religious-based?
The number of students attending religious schools is about 78%. So
most of the most of the private schools have a religious affiliation of some kind, either non-denominational or Catholic, Christian. There's some Jewish and Muslim schools that take part. Many of them are religious.
Now, wait, hold on, Beth. Doesn't that violate the separation of church and state? You're talking about taxpayer dollars sending kids to religious schools.
Right. So that issue was challenged in terms of the Opportunity Scholarship, I believe. That issue, and Leslie, remind me that there was a challenge on the Florida Tax Credit Scholarship, but the state Supreme Court didn't take that up.
Right. That was a part of the challenge that was filed in 2014 against the tax credit scholarships, but the courts basically ruled because that one is not a direct state appropriation, because it's that money that's actually going from the corporation, you know, donated and not a directly from the state budget, that was not an issue. So that challenge did not go anywhere. And then way back early on, the first scholarship program was challenged partly on those grounds. The Florida Supreme Court did say that that program could not continue, although they did not actually decide it on the religious issue. They decided it on another part of the Florida Constitution.
Again, I'm talking with Leslie Postol and Beth Kassab, both of the Orlando Sentinel. They're part of a team that just published a three-part series called Schools Without Rules. Again, looking at private schools that receive state taxpayer dollars in the form of scholarships so that kids can go to these schools if they feel their schools are failing them. You know what? Going through this story, the thing that stood out wasn't so much the debate over these scholarships and, you know, and if we should be paying families to send their kids to religious schools or private schools, but it's the schools that you were pointing out and some of the problems they were having. What did you find in your investigation that really jumped out at you about what some of these schools were really doing?
Well, in Florida, the system is set up by design for there to be very, very minimal regulations on the private schools. So one of the things that we found interesting is that state statutes explicitly say that the legislature does not want to regulate these private schools that are, as you pointed out, receiving a lot of money through state programs. So these schools are free to teach any kind of curriculum they would like. They do not have to follow state academic standards. They are free to hire almost anyone they would like. We found, teachers without college degrees, principals without college degrees. The state does say that these schools are not allowed to hire people who cannot pass a criminal background check. But we found that does, in fact, happen because the state does not routinely check to make sure the schools have followed through on this. So over the years, they have found, cases where a school has hired someone with certain criminal convictions.
If I may ask, do you know of any other state program where state dollars are going in and there isn't some kind of oversight?
That's an interesting question because as you look around the country, there are now quite a few of these tax credit scholarship programs or other voucher type programs. And many of them have quite a bit more oversight than the state of Florida does. For example, the state of Indiana and the state of Louisiana, they have fairly robust programs, but they assign letter grades to the private schools just as they do public schools. And like we do here for public schools in the state of Florida, the state looks at testing data and other points in the cases of high schools and comes up with a letter grade. And so in some states you see that state education departments are doing that for private schools as well. So each state program operates a different way. I haven't found one yet that is exactly like the other. But some of the academic researchers I talked to, one person I spoke with, he said, Florida does bear a distinction in this way. It's one of the more minimally regulated programs.
Leslie, has any politician ever mentioned why they don't want tougher regulations of these schools. I mean, would they send their kids to these kind of schools if they knew what they were sending them into?
Well, I can't answer that part, but certainly they say that, you know, they think that parents know their kids best, and parents will make the best decisions for their children, and we should leave it up to parents.
Again, I'm talking with Leslie Postal and Beth Kassab, both of the Orlando Sentinel. We're talking about their new series that just came out, a three-part series called Schools Without Rules, talking about private schools where kids are getting taxpayer dollars in these scholarships to be able to go to these schools. But when we come back from the break, we're going to talk about some of the stuff they found in their investigation of what these private schools are doing and not doing. That's all coming up on Sundial here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. I'm joined by Leslie Postal and Beth Kassab, both reporters with the Orlando Sentinel. And again, they published a three-part series recently called Schools Without Rules. And it looks at private schools throughout the state of Florida that are receiving almost more than $1 billion of taxpayer dollars, taxpayer money for kids to go to these private schools. You know, Leslie, one of the things I was really shocked by in reading this series was that there are teachers with criminal records. You talked about one who had been caught with child pornography on their computer. You had a principal who was accused of molesting a student. First of all, when parents sign their kids up at these schools, is that information available that they can ask about or that anybody would even tell them?
I don't know that anybody would tell them. I mean, the schools are supposed to do criminal background checks on all their employees who have contact with students, and the principal needs to sign something for the state that has been done. But the state doesn't actually look at those records unless something else comes up and then they feel some need to request them. So there's really no check on whether those have been done.
And
so
if I'm a parent and I find out, then who can I call?
Well, you could contact the Department of Education and they would, you know, confirm that, and they would tell the school this person needs to be terminated if you want to keep your scholarships.
Beth,
so they do act if they find out, but they just don't necessarily always find out.
But at the same time, you also pointed out in some cases, if a school is shut down or if somebody has to be let go, they can just pop up somewhere else and open up another school and get money.
Right. So the State Department of Education cannot actually shut a school down, but it can suspend a school's scholarships. And some of these schools are very reliant on the scholarships. So in some cases, if a school wasn't receiving this money from the state, they wouldn't have any other money coming in. So indirectly, not having the scholarships could shut them down. It is fairly easy to open up a school here in Florida and receive approval to receive these scholarships. You do have to hit a short checklist. But as we reported in one of our stories, there was a school in Palm Bay, Florida, and that school had a principal who was a pastor. And a student at the school accused this individual of improperly touching her. And she, along with her parents, filed a police report. And so the police began investigating the case. Another parent at that school tipped off the Department of Education that this was going on. And that prompted the department to start asking that school for some records. Like Leslie mentioned, they can ask for updated background checks and other information. But the principal who was under investigation never responded to those letters from the Department of Education. So the department over that summer ended up pulling that school's scholarships. But by the time that action was final, that same principal, along with his wife, had simply opened up another school under a different name and a different address. And eventually, later during that school year, this person was charged with a crime based on that police investigation. And so the department then suspended the scholarships from that second school. And in its letter to that school said, "We have reason to believe that this is the same school that was operating before." So So as you can see, there is the potential for some churn here. And, you know, the Department of Education in Tallahassee is overseeing now some 2,000 of these private schools.
And Leslie, help us understand one of the things that you had mentioned in the story is that the state really only checks about 10 schools per year, though the last couple of years it's been a couple dozen at a time. But why do they limit themselves to just checking a few schools? What if there are a lot of complaints coming in?
Well, the state law says they can only check 10 unless they are checking on schools that there have been problems previously. So every year they randomly check 10. They have a computer system that spits out which 10 those will be. And then they do visit others where there have been some reports of problems. So like we said, they visited 22 last year. They visited 27 the year before, and I think 19 the year before that. The thing that really struck us is they visited very few, but they seemed to find problems at most of them. When they visited the 27, only 4 were compliant. When they visited the 19, only 1 was compliant with even the limited rules they're supposed to follow. So that kind of struck us.
And, you know, there are other states do handle that in other ways. I noticed that the state of Indiana requires its Department of Education to visit at least 5% of schools. So here in Florida, that would be, I believe, roughly 100 schools, if my math is correct. So you know, that's quite a bit higher than what they're doing right now.
Now, of course, you know, we've been talking about some of the problems that you found in your investigation at some of these schools, but I mean, really, there have to be some success stories, right?
Oh, absolutely.
Oh, sure.
You know, there are. And we went out of our way to visit a broad variety of schools. We wanted to see new schools and old schools. We wanted to see large schools and small schools. We wanted to see, you know, long-established schools with a history of success. We went to a lot of schools. We went to more than 45 here in the Central Florida region. And, yeah, absolutely, we went to schools that are by all accounts doing a great job.
But Beth, since they don't, because my understanding is they don't have to take the state standard test that school kids in public schools do. So how do we measure their success compared to all the other kids?
Well, I mean, I'm sorry, this is Leslie. Some of the students are required to take a test, a nationalized, you know, standardized test, but it's a test of their school's choosing. The state does do a report on that, but only like 283 of the schools were included in last year's report. So it doesn't cover nearly all the schools. So for many of the schools, there is no way to look up test score data or something like that. I mean, you'd have to just ask the school if they could tell you something.
You both had the opportunity to talk to families, and I wanted to get a sense of, you know, why parents think those who took their kids out of public schools and put them into private schools, and some of these schools, again, were run by, as you said, like a pastor or small groups, couples, and some of the schools, by the way, not even on campuses, they're, you know, in facilities that, well, they're kind of questionable. I know you pointed out one school, there was a room that was empty and they were calling that the library. But,
right.
You know, I'm wondering, what are parents saying about why they think that's such a better line for their kids to take than staying in public schools?
Well, one thing we found is that here in Florida, there is an emphasis in the public school system on testing. There is a law that says third graders who do not pass the reading Florida Standards Assessment, I believe it is, the FSA, those children can be retained, held back in third grade. This seemed to be a big driving force. Parents were upset about standardized tests, were concerned that these tests were impacting their children, that their children didn't like them. And this is one of the reasons people told us that they're choosing these schools. And some people also, they want a smaller environment than a public school would provide. You know, they want a faith-based curriculum, which, you know, you're not going to find in a public school. So there's a variety of reasons for why people are very, very interested in these scholarships. So the scholarships are in high demand. The program has grown every year.
And do you have a sense of how many schools wouldn't even exist if not for the program?
You know, that's a good question. I don't know if I have an exact count for you off the top of my head, but we have looked at that data over the years here at the Orlando Sentinel, and it's a high percentage of schools that are fairly reliant on the programs in terms of revenue.
Right, and we spoke with one school in Kissimmee, which has grown considerably. I think it has more than 400 scholarship students this year, and the owner even said, you know, the scholarships are the only reason a private school can stand strong. I mean, she wouldn't, you know, she didn't see her school existing really without them.
You know, I also wanted to point out, too, that some of these scholarships are for special needs kids.
Right.
And what did you find in your investigation as to whether or not, you know, we're talking about kids who could have autism or other special needs, are they getting the care that they need? Because in some cases, I mean, you have to have people who are specially trained, but are they getting that kind of, you know, that kind of treatment and that kind of help?
I'm
sorry, Leslie, go ahead.
I think that's a good question. And I think in some ways we just don't know. I mean, certainly some of the reason that parents also leave public school is feeling like they're not doing a good job with their meeting their child's special needs. And certainly some parents feel like they've found better solutions in some of these private schools. But we also spoke to parents who felt like, you know, they promised them good specialized help and that never happened. And they really didn't have staff well-trained to deal with a particular disability. I think we did point out in the story that, you know, the state website lists all these disabilities that schools can accommodate, but doesn't require the private schools to verify that in some way. So, you know, the school may say it can teach your child with autism, but doesn't have to offer any proof that their staff is well trained in that specialty.
Let me finish on this. Since the series came out, what have you heard from your readers? What I'd imagine anybody else coming forward with a story you know, maybe they thought they were the only ones, but they wanted to share it with you.
Oh, yeah. We have heard quite a bit from readers, both people who are big supporters of the scholarship program. They want to see it continue. They want to see it expand. They say it's been a lifesaver for their family and their student. And we've heard from people who said, just like what you said, saying, hey, I want to tell you about my experience, which wasn't so good. So we've heard a big spectrum of reaction, and we've talked to lawmakers and others and some who say that the program could use more oversight.
Again, I've been talking with Beth Kassab and Leslie Postal, both of the Orlando Sentinel. They just finished a three-part series called Schools Without Rules, looking again at the popularity of these scholarships that are given by the state to families so they can send their kids to private schools, and a really interesting look at these schools and what they're doing and what they're not doing for our kids. Leslie, Beth, I really appreciate your time. Thanks so much for sharing.
Thank you.
Well, yeah, thanks for having us.
All right. All right, coming up, we're going to turn our attention to the stars. Are you a stargazer? Do you have a telescope? Come on, you can admit it. I used to have one. We're going to talk about some celestial happenings because we're going to geek out on astronomy. That's all coming up next here on Sundial, here on WLRN. Welcome back to Sundial here on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. So when's the last time you really stopped and took a moment to look up at the stars? And I mean, really just look at the constellations, maybe spot a meteor or stare at the moon. Well, there's still a good reason to look up at the sky because we're going through the Orionid meteor shower. It's still going on, even though the peak passed. Still a good chance to look up and catch something. This is a meteor shower that was caused by Halley's Comet. And if you recall, that passed the Earth back in 1986, and it won't come back again until 2061. So come on, admit it. You once owned or you wish you did a telescope. You missed the wonderment when you looked up through that eyepiece and you saw all sorts of wonderful things. Let's talk about astronomy, especially some of these celestial things that are happening right now. We're joined by Susan Barnett, director of the Bueller Planetarium at Broward College in Davie. Susan, welcome to the program.
Well, thank you very much. Glad to be here.
You know what? Right now we have, as I mentioned, this Orionid meteor shower. Help us understand how this was caused. This was by Halley's Comet. That was 30 years ago.
Yes, and actually the comet's been around a lot longer than just 30 years. You see, the Earth is actually hit by debris from space every single day. When you look up and you see a meteor in the sky, the little streak of light, you're seeing some space debris, whether it's the size of a piece of sand or bigger, coming in at thousands of miles an hour and hitting our atmosphere and burning up. Most of them burn up before they hit the ground. That's what you're seeing when you see that streak of light. A meteor shower is when we have a predictable time to see a whole lot of these. So this was caused by Halley's Comet, and comets are litter bugs. Every time a comet comes close into the inner solar system and develops that wonderful coma and tail, it's scattering more dust and debris that every one of those particles travels around the same orbit.
But
and
Susan,
as they spread out, it litters the whole orbit. So when the Earth crosses that path, we get a meteor shower.
But, you know, Susan, that, again, as I said, that comet passed 30 years ago. It would cause a meteor shower now?
Absolutely. You see, that comet has been following that same path for thousands of years. So it has scattered dust all along its orbit. So like I said, comets are litter bugs. And when the Earth crosses the orbit of where the comet has been, it acts like a giant vacuum cleaner.
All right, so this the peak of this Orionid meteor shower was this past weekend, but it will still last through this week as well. How was it, by the way? I mean, what did you get to see?
Well, I got to confess, I haven't spent a lot of time with this meteor shower. It's been awfully cloudy. You need a good dark sky to see it. This one is one of the medium meteor showers, as I call it. At its peak, you might see 20 meteors an hour. Now, think about that. It's not like a science fiction opening, the opening to a movie, where things are constantly streaking across the sky. You might get one meteor, and a couple of minutes later, another one. So a meteor shower is a nice leisurely event. We're actually having a better one coming up in December, and that's called the Geminids. That's where we might get 100 meteors an hour.
So something to mark on your calendar and make sure that you get ready for that one. I did read about, by the way, some folks along the East Coast, not this far south, had seen a big fireball in the sky just a few days ago. This is a little bit further north, but was that a meteor?
Yes, it was. A fireball is just a bigger meteor. So they can get so bright from the friction coming in through the atmosphere, they can even be seen in the daytime. So, depending on the angle at which they're coming into the atmosphere, some of those could even survive to become meteorites that we could pick up off the ground.
And how often, when you see a meteor shower, how often do you actually have debris that hits the Earth? I mean, some of it burns up in the atmosphere.
A lot of it burns up in the atmosphere. We figure we're probably getting about 100 tons of material a day hitting the Earth. That's 100 tons. Now, very little of that is going to make it to the surface of the Earth. Will we find it? Well, the percentages are even smaller there. Remember, 70% of the Earth is covered with water.
So chances are we're probably not going to catch one. All right.
Right.
You know, one of the things I noticed, too, is I thought about this is, and I haven't done any stargazing in a very, very, very long time, but it's the fact that, you know, we live in this part of the country. We live in a very populated area, and so we have a lot of light pollution from the cities. Not as easy to stargaze out here, but what do you advise people on the best way to get around that?
Well, we still can see quite a lot of things in the sky, even with our light pollution. From our observatory here on campus right now, we're watching Saturn and its moons, and it's beautiful. But if people really want to take the time and spend some time with the sky, I recommend they either go to the beach or maybe drive out into the Everglades a little bit. One of the rest areas off of 595 might make a great place to sit and watch the sky. I know for a fact you can even see the Milky Way when you're driving on 595. That's why they don't let me drive at night.
Okay, well, yeah, pull over, take a moment, yes. You know, I was looking at the calendar as well. There's another event that's coming up in mid-November, and it's called the Conjunction of Venus and Jupiter. Please explain what that means.
All right, a conjunction is simply where when you look in one direction, you see things close together. And in this case, the planets Jupiter and Venus, they're not really going to be close together. Venus's orbit is between us and the sun. Jupiter's orbit is farther out in the solar system. But they're both going to be in the same line of sight. Now, these are two of the brightest objects we see in the sky at night. they are going to be so close together that they're going to be less than half a degree apart. And to give you an idea, hold your arm out straight and put up your thumb. Your thumbnail is about half a degree. That would actually cover the full moon. So Jupiter and Saturn, these two very bright objects, will be closer together than that. Of course, you got to get up before sunrise to see it, or stay up until then.
All right. Now, as you're asking a lot of me, that's not as easy. It was easy when I was younger. It was a lot easier when I was younger. You know what? I was wondering, you know, what have you seen over the last few years when it comes to people's interest in celestial events like this? I know that we recently had, earlier this year, we had the solar eclipse, and that was a big deal. But, you know, for meteor showers and other things, I mean, do you see people really still interested in that stuff?
Actually, yes, I do. Because there are several meteor showers every year that are always pretty good, like the Orionids, like the Geminids in December, like the Leonids. But I think what people have to remember about meteor showers is that they are leisurely events. The tools and the equipment that you need to watch a meteor shower is a lawn chair. I recommend a lawn chair, good company, your favorite beverage, and just be willing to spend some time watching the sky.
All right. I want to ask you this question. I'm just curious. Do you remember the first time you had a telescope? And what did you
see?
What did you see?
Well, the first telescope I ever was around was my brother's, and I wasn't allowed to touch it.
Of course
except
not.
Except when he was there. Now, when he comes to visit, I show him all the telescopes I get to play with here at the college. But I do remember having him show me the moon, and seeing even something as common as the moon through a telescope is amazing to people, because you're seeing it in detail. You're seeing the mountains. You're seeing the craters. You're seeing the contrast of the light and the dark. So get started, whether it's with a pair of binoculars or just with a lawn chair looking up at the stars.
Susan Barnett, director of the Bueller Planetarium at Broward College in Davie. Thank you so much, Susan, for joining us today.
Lewis, it's been my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
And you know what? Things are looking up. Coming up tomorrow on Sundial, we're going to look at the problems and challenges they're facing at Lake Okeechobee. Is the dike in trouble? And then we're going to meet one of the winners of this year's MacArthur Fellows Genius Grants. And we're going to have a conversation with the Diva Whisperer, Richard Alexander. That's all coming up tomorrow on Sundial.